This is the Thrive Content Cast. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Content Cast. My name is Bronte and I'm a learning designer here at Thrive. Today I'm joined by Dr. Catherine Hill, who is a fertility education advocate and part of the team behind Fertility Network, a patient-focused charity here in the UK. And today we're going to be talking about the impact of fertility, particularly in the workplace. So hi, Catherine, it's lovely to have you on the podcast.
Hi, Bronte, it's lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
No worries. Why don't you start by, I guess, introducing yourself and how and why you became a fertility education advocate?
Yes, so I'm Dr. Catherine Hill. I'm the head of policy and public affairs at Fertility Network, but I also have a different work head, if you will, and this is how I became a fertility education advocate, because I was told just a few days before my 21st birthday that I was probably infertile. It was a massive shock. It was told to me very bluntly in a phone call. I'd had chlamydia, which was also a massive shock, and it had damaged my fallopian tubes. And there was just absolutely no support, nobody to talk to. And I just shoved it down inside me. And I didn't talk about it. I didn't talk about it for decades. Then in my 30s, my background's as a science journalist, I suddenly thought, I want to write a book about the vagina. And I did. It's been a massive success, published around the world under my maiden name, Blackledge. But it was only after I'd written the book, I realised that that came from my infertility. It came from my desire to understand what it meant to be a woman if you couldn't have children. It came from my desire to understand what it is to be a woman. And I really felt I didn't have any fertility education. There wasn't any when I was at school. There still is a very limited amount. And I really felt that if I'd known more about my fertility, the powers of my female body, then I probably would have been strong enough to say, no, wear a condom, and would not have contracted chlamydia. And I want other girls and women to be strong enough to know about their fertility, to be able to protect themselves when they need to protect themselves. And it's not just women who need to know about fertility, it's men too. So both in my work writing nonfiction books and now working for the National Fertility Charity Fertility Network, you know, that is my aim, to be a fertility education advocate. And I am infertile. I can't have children without medical help. I finally met the man I wanted to have children with when I was in my mid-30s, and we started trying when I was 37. But of course, it didn't work because my fallopian tubes are damaged. And we went to have IVF. I couldn't have NHS-funded IVF. One reason would be by the time I got to the top of the waiting list, it wasn't available in my area. But also, I have a wonderful stepdaughter. I first met her when she was 12, and she hasn't ever lived with us. She lived then with her mum. But because I have a stepdaughter, the rules around who gets to have NHS-funded fertility treatment meant that I wouldn't be allowed to, although I had the medical problem. You know, it shouldn't be like that, but I was penalised for having a stepdaughter. It's absolutely crazy. And in actual fact, in England, about 90% of all the integrated care boards don't allow you to access NHS treatment if one of the couple has a child from a previous relationship. It doesn't matter if you have a fertility problem, but you're not allowed to access treatment. And anyway, I went through multiple rounds of IVF, failures, miscarriage. But I am one of the lucky ones, and I finally gave birth to my daughter just before my 42nd birthday. So I never, ever forget how lucky I am. And then that's how I ended up working for Fertility Network, because I wanted to give something back, wanted to help other people who are in this situation. And the charity, we're celebrating our 20th birthday this year, which is absolutely wonderful. 20 years of providing free and impartial information and support to anyone thinking about their fertility. So that could be you're not actively trying to conceive, but you're thinking about your fertility. You could be thinking about egg freezing. You could just need more information about what is normal for fertility. Or you could be actively trying to conceive. You could be struggling with fertility treatment. We also provide support for people who have been through what is often a traumatic fertility journey, and they have been successful, but that traumatic fertility journey impacts on them. It impacts on them during their pregnancy and after their baby has arrived. So we provide support there as well. And we provide support for people who aren't successful with fertility treatment. And as wonderful as IVF is, and it's an incredible technology, it's nearly 46 years old now, but it still doesn't work the majority of the time. So there are, although there have been millions of babies, I think it's up to about 9 million babies born worldwide as a result of IVF, there are a lot of people for whom IVF didn't work, and we support those as well. And it's also important to remember that when you aren't able to have children, that's something that stays with you for a lifetime. So if you aren't able to be a mother, you're not able to be a grandmother as well. So we offer that support throughout somebody's lifespan. So it's a lot of people we support. The figures are 1 in 6 people have fertility struggles. It's a lot of people, and there's a lot of work to be done.
I think that's everything you've talked about is like a huge motivator behind wanting to do this podcast and having you on today, because, you know, being a 28-year-old female myself, like I know that, you know, when you do actually, it's only when you kind of start to try to conceive that you realize everything that happens. And it's such a taboo topic in the workplace, especially, but also with kind of family and friends too, you know. But it's great that charities like Fertility Network exist. And it's so great to hear that you've been, you know, supporting so many people and for such a long time as well. I'm sure we'll dive into a bit more in terms of like the NHS and infertility a little bit later. But I think let's start with talking about some of the fertility challenges that you come across within the charity, but also, I guess, just in life as well. You know, I know you mentioned a few, but is there any that you've come across outside of that?
Yes, there are so many fertility challenges. And one of the things that you said is really key. It is that people feel so alone. And that's one of the biggest challenges on a fertility journey. And our aim is to make sure that no one does feel alone. And it's understandable to not want to talk about fertility struggles. It's a really intimate topic. You know, you're having to talk about sex and penises and vaginas, and it's, you know, it's an incredibly intimate journey. You literally have to reveal yourself to so many people. So it's very understandable that people don't want to talk. But from our work, we know that it can make such a massive difference to people if they can either talk to counsellors or talk to people who've been through a similar situation. We have one of the supports that we provide is we have a range of peer support groups. Most are still meeting online. They didn't used to, but post-COVID, the majority of them do. And they are all free groups. There are two different types. There are the regional groups, so there will be some where in your area where you can meet up online, or a few of them face to face with somebody else who's going through this situation. And we also have what we call our specialty groups, and they are we recognise that there are different aspects to people's fertility journey. So we actually have, our group is called HIM Fertility, and that's a men-only group. And our research and our experience has shown us that men prefer to have a male-only group. It's open to men with fertility problems and also men supporting their partner with fertility problems. And I know some of the men we've worked with have said it's just transformed their lives being able to talk about this openly. As well as our male-only group, we have a group for single women, so women hoping to become solo mums via IVF. We have an LGBT plus group as well. We have 40 and over, secondary infertility, because secondary infertility can feel just as painful as primary infertility. So you have been able to conceive and have one child, but you would like to have another. You had an idea of a family of a particular size. So we have a secondary infertility group. We have a group for Black women, for Asian women, a whole host of specialty groups, because we recognise that there are specific issues that come up, and it can be so helpful having somebody else who's in that situation. And we also have a support line, which is staffed by two former fertility nurses. So if you do have any question, or you just need someone to talk to or a shoulder to cry on, those lines are open Monday to Friday. You can just phone up and ask for help. And we do have an information line as well, where you can ask us any question that you might want about fertility treatment. So yes, we have a whole spread of support in that way that will hopefully help people feel not alone on their fertility journey.
That's a lot of support. I love all the different groups that you have as well. That's amazing to hear. You obviously mentioned about the impact. I think there's two parts to this, the impact outside of the workplace and in the workplace. So I guess maybe we could talk first about the impact of people's fertility journeys on individuals. You mentioned obviously solo IVF and on couples as well.
Yeah. So we did a large survey with Middlesex University. It's just over a year ago now, looking at the impact of infertility and its treatment. The results were really shocking. Infertility has a massive impact on so many areas of a person's life. First and foremost, it has a massive mental health impact. So the majority of people who responded to our survey said that they were depressed, but really, really shockingly, 40% of people said they were suicidal, and 10% of those said they felt suicidal pretty much all the time, which is deeply shocking. And we do know that the mental distress is incredibly high with fertility patients. It causes a life crisis. It causes people to really think about who they are and what they want in life. So that's one of the absolutely massive things that happens. But there's a greater impact as well. It's like a perfect storm, if you will. So it's emotionally devastating not being able to have the child that you long for. But fertility patients face a series of other hurdles. Fertility treatment itself, in the UK, unfortunately, because of how fertility treatment's rationed, the majority of patients have to pay for their own treatment. And it's financially crippling. In our survey, we found the average amount that people are paying is over £13,000. But around 1 in 10 couples are spending more than £30,000 on treatment. And some are spending up to £100,000. You know, it's absolutely financially crippling. There's also a big impact on a person's career. And we found in this survey that more than 1 in 10 respondents, 15%, either reduced their hours at work or quit their job. Over a third felt their career was damaged as a result of going through fertility treatment. And the majority felt that fertility treatment would affect their career prospects. We asked people about, is there a supportive workplace policy in place? But only a quarter of people said that they did have a workplace policy. And also, although we've done several in the past looking at whether people tell their employers that they are going through fertility treatment, and when we first did the survey back in 2016, we found that the majority of people said they did not disclose to their employer. But there was a shift in this most recent survey, and the majority, 77%, said they did disclose. But less than half of those said that after disclosing that there weren't any reasonable adjustments made for them. And less than half of all people said they felt that they received good support from their employer, which is really sad. Another area of impact is on relationships. And sadly, going through IVF, going through the struggles of IVF, which can take months, years, it often takes a toll on relationships. And the majority of people reported some detrimental impact on their relationship. Marriages end, partners leave. Though I have to say that isn't always the case. Sometimes going through this level of a struggle together can really cement a bond. So it isn't always the case, but for the majority of people, it does have a detrimental effect. And we also looked at what kind of support patients were getting elsewhere. But 75% of patients said they felt let down by the support that they received from their GP. They didn't feel it was adequate. And we know of so many people who've come to us and said that they just felt dismissed by their GP. You know, they'd gone to them with concerns and they were just told to go away and keep on trying. So that all these different ways in which infertility and its treatment impact people. And, you know, it's bad enough going through having to go through fertility struggles, but then having to pay for your own treatment, not getting the support you need in your workplace, your relationship struggling as a result, your GP not providing you with the correct level of information. You know, it can be an absolutely devastating time for people.
Yeah, I can imagine. And let's go back quickly to those. You mentioned reasonable adjustments in work and people feeling like they didn't have that and let down. What support, I guess, does Fertility Network do for fertility in the workplace? And what are some of those reasonable adjustments that workplaces can offer or managers can offer their, you know, their employees going through fertility struggles?
We have been looking at this area of fertility in the workplace and how to support people for around 20 years now. In fact, right from the start, back in 2024, we worked with Unison in Scotland. And actually, as a result of our work there, all 32 local authorities implemented a fertility policy. And we now have our initiative, our Fertility in the Workplace initiative, which is there to provide support for employers in order that they can understand what their employees are going through and provide them with the necessary support. So it works in a number of ways. Part of the initiative, if you're a small or medium enterprise, a woman in a small or medium enterprise, we can actually offer free support for you. So do get in touch if that is you and you need some support. We also work with larger organisations who perhaps want to implement a fertility policy. And a fertility policy can tell you, say, for example, if you are going through fertility treatment, how many days off work you're entitled for the treatment that you're going through. Because at the moment in the UK, there is no mandatory right to time off work for fertility treatment, which is absolutely crazy. So fertility policies can help because, one, patients know that there is support for them. They can know how many days off work they may be entitled to. But our work goes beyond just looking at how to implement a fertility policy. It's also about working with managers and other staff. We go in, we do one-to-one meetings where we talk about what fertility treatment actually entails so that people understand what level of support is needed. In terms of necessary adjustments when you're going through fertility treatment, you need to inject yourself regularly. Your drugs need to be in a fridge so that employers can have that safe space for those things to happen and a fridge for drugs. So there's lots of ways in which employers can create that safe space. Another example is that working in an organisation, other people have babies. That can make people feel very uncomfortable when people bring their babies or children to work. But if employers know that somebody is struggling with fertility treatment, they can make sure that they're not included or that messages to all staff are communicated in a way that doesn't trigger people. So having an understanding of the struggles and the mental distress that fertility treatment cause can really help support patients. And you know, we work with patients who said that just knowing that their employer understands and they have somebody they can talk to about it, makes a massive difference. And we've recently started a fertility ambassador program, and it's for anybody has got experience of fertility struggles and would like to be an ambassador, fertility ambassador in the workplace. Get in contact with us and we can provide support and training so that you can help others in your place of work. So many people struggle with fertility treatment at work, and there are clear reasons for it, not just because of the level of mental distress, but because if you're going through fertility treatment, it's a really time-consuming process, and you do need to have time off work, and you do need a supportive manager who can say, oh, okay, you could work from home now if it makes it easier to, because it can be hours to drive to the fertility clinic to have regular blood tests or scans. And also, when fertility treatment doesn't work, you know, we've spoken with so many people who said, you know, I've miscarried at work, but that should not be happening. There should be the support available so that individuals can talk to their managers and, you know, have that support during their journey.
There's loads of tangible things that you've given there, and obviously we'll give lots of links to things that you've talked about, especially the website where Fertility Network website, where people can find all of this information and ways that they can support their colleagues or managers can support, you know, their employees as well. And I think it works all together, right? Because if you want people to be open about what they're going through, and as an employer or manager, you want to support those people, you have to build a workplace that is open and honest and provides that support and care for people. So doing it from the top and implementing policies is a really, you know, that's like the starting point that has to be there, right? You know, we have it for so many other things, and companies these days will have, you know, mental health days off, but there does need to be more of an awareness for people going through their fertility journey in the workplace. I think you mentioned earlier something about like the financial burdens of fertility and how some couples were spending up to, you know, 30 grand or 100 grand on treatments. The impact of the cost of living crisis, obviously we're all feeling it. It'd be really good to discuss how people going through their fertility journeys feel that financial burden, and I guess how that links with the NHS and how you can, you know, postcode lottery, how many treatments you can have, how long you have to wait before you get those treatments. So yeah, just that whole area.
Yes, we did a survey just before Christmas looking at the impact of the cost of living crisis on fertility patients. And we conducted the survey because we knew that there was a big impact, but we were still really shocked when we got the survey results. You know, the vast majority, 95% of respondents, were experiencing financial worries in relation to fertility treatment. And for most of those, it had been exacerbated by the cost of living crisis. The key finding was that patients are being priced out of becoming parents. And there is massive, half of all our respondents were not able at that point in time to continue with treatment. Some were just delaying treatment, but some were stopping it completely. And of course, you know, time's of the essence with fertility treatment. But others were actually facing the destruction of their embryos. So they had already created embryos. Those embryos were in storage, but they didn't have the money to either do an embryo transfer or to continue to store them. So they're actually facing the destruction of their embryos because of the cost of living crisis. And we also found that more than a third of patients were looking at ways to cut costs of fertility treatment. And that could be not having their preferred treatment, such as not having fertility treatment add-ons. But in some cases, and this is what we were deeply, deeply concerned about, some patients were actually doing things that were potentially risky for their own health and for their babies, any future baby's health. So for example, some patients told us that they were choosing to have double embryo transfers rather than a single embryo transfer because it was cheaper for them. But the risk to mum and baby of having twins, so it's one of the greatest health risks in IVF treatment. And clinics, single embryo treatment is the aim for clinics. We also had people telling us that they felt that they'd been forced into egg sharing programs in order to cut costs. So an egg sharing program is where your treatment, your IVF treatment, is at a reduced cost if you agree that when your ovaries are stimulated and you produce eggs, then you agree that half of those eggs are donated to the clinic and they will go to another patient and half of the eggs are for you to use. Now, egg sharing programs may be right for some people, but there are massive ethical considerations before going through one of these programs. And to feel that you're being forced into that because of cost issues, we're deeply concerned about that. And there are other things, people saying that they couldn't afford to have necessary monitoring scans, so they just weren't having them. And as a charity, we feel that we're at a crisis point right now, with the majority of people in the UK having to pay for their own treatment because of the lack of NHS access. There's a high cost of fertility treatment in the UK. We're also concerned because patients said they felt that clinics weren't doing enough to support them. And, you know, they're repeatedly putting up prices, a lack of clarity around cost, and no payment packages to spread out costs. So patients were having to pay, you know, thousands of pounds up front rather than it being spread out over the course of their treatment. And all of this was having a serious effect on patients' mental health. They're literally having to choose between eating, having a baby, they're not doing, people tell us they're literally not doing anything. They're not going out, they're not having haircuts, they're just not doing anything because they're desperately trying to save up for treatment. But in doing so, their mental health is really suffering. And, you know, there's an unrelenting toll on their mental health. The patients said they're basically not living and they're racking up mountains of debt. So I think it's a really serious situation in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, it just seems absolutely mental that when you're already going through fertility, struggles, that you have to then worry about the financial burden and the cost of living. It just doesn't sit right at all. With the NHS, I think I read somewhere that you either have to wait, is it 12 months before you have any testing done, or you have to experience at least 3 miscarriages. I'm not sure whether you know any more about that.
Yes, so it can vary. And when I say it can vary, the situation in the UK is that in England, funding for fertility treatment is decided on a local basis. So each integrated care board will decide who can access treatment. In Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland, NHS funding for fertility treatment is centralised, so everybody gets the same level of treatment. Now, there is guidance around what level of treatment people should get. That national guidance says that women under 40 should have access to 3 full IVF cycles, and that word full is important. And if you are aged between 40 to 42, you should have access to 1 full IVF cycle. But that guidance is not mandatory, and that's the big problem. So it isn't followed. So the best place to live in the UK is in Scotland, where there is access to 3 full IVF cycles, and that's been in place since April 2017, and that was as a result of our campaigning. In Northern Ireland, until recently, it was just 1 partial IVF cycle, and I'll explain in a moment what that means, but they've actually just announced that they're moving to 1 full IVF cycle. And in Wales, at the moment, you have access to 2 full IVF cycles, though last year they did say that they were going to change that and move to 2 partial IVF cycles. And by the way, this is all for women under 40. In England, it just depends where you live. There's a handful of places, only about 2 or 3, where you can get 3 full IVF cycles. The majority offer 1 partial cycle. And there's a big difference between a full IVF cycle and a partial cycle. And this is one of the ways in which the different areas ration access. So the definition of a full IVF cycle is you go through ovarian stimulation, you produce however many eggs. You then hopefully produce however many embryos, and it could be as many as 10 embryos from 1 ovulation. stimulation cycle. So you have 10 embryos. Now, if you're having a full IVF cycle, one embryo will be put back. If that doesn't work, then all the other viable embryos, which at that point would have been frozen, would be replaced one at a time until you were had success with those one of those embryos. So if you're having a full IVF cycle and you've produced 10 embryos, you've got 10 chances of success. But what the majority of areas now say is you can only have a partial IVF cycle. Typically it's one fresh, one frozen. So even though you may have produced 10 embryos, they will only transfer two of them. Some areas only say you can have one embryo transfer, and then all the other embryos remain in storage, and you will end up having to pay for those. You usually get about a year's storage. But that's why we're in the situation where people have embryos in storage but can't afford to use them. And sometimes they say you can have two partial cycles, so you may have embryos in storage that you want to use, but then women are being forced to go through another round of ovarian stimulation, and there are health risks associated with that. So we are campaigning against these partial IVF cycles because they're unethical. We believe if embryos are created in the NHS, they should be used within the NHS. But to go back a little bit to what you were saying, which is that if you are trying to conceive and you haven't had any success, in most areas, if you go to your doctor after a year of trying, they will start doing some fertility tests and investigations. Some areas, they may say you have to be trying for 2 years. If you're over 35, it should definitely only be 1 year. Now, those fertility tests and investigations could be a laparoscopy to look at whether your fallopian tubes are working okay. There'll be semen tests on men. Whole range of fertility tests and investigations. But unfortunately, there are long waiting times, long NHS waiting times for a lot of these tests. In Wales, we've heard that some of the waiting times are over 2 years for the tests. And, you know, I've said it before, but like time is of the essence when it comes to fertility treatment. So to have to wait for 2 years for tests, necessary tests for to see whether you will be referred for fertility treatment. It's outrageous, absolutely outrageous. And in fact, the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they did a report looking at waiting times, and waiting times for women's health are far longer than any other areas of the sector. So you have tests and investigations, and perhaps you get a diagnosis of why you're not conceiving, but perhaps you don't as well. And that is labelled as unexplained infertility. And typically after 2 years of trying to conceive, one of which could have been while you're having the tests and investigations, you will hopefully, if it's available in your area, be referred for NHS-funded fertility treatment. But there then can be another delay while you're waiting for that treatment to start, and that can be months or longer. So it can take a long time from starting trying to conceive, realizing there's a problem, before you actually get to the fertility clinic. And you mentioned about miscarriages, and sadly in some areas in the UK they say that if you have a miscarriage while you're trying to conceive, that clock, the clock of you've got to have been trying for 1 year or 2 years before being referred for treatment, that clock is set back to zero, because massively cruelly they say that, well, the fact that you had a miscarriage shows that you can conceive. And we've been contacted by people who've had multiple miscarriages and then had to wait 1 year or 2 years before progressing further down the line. And that's another area that we're campaigning against, because it's massively unfair, that and that should not be happening. So it can be such a struggle to actually get to have fertility treatment and take an incredibly long time.
I think obviously this is not video recorded, just audio recorded, but I think for our listeners, most of my jaw was dropped at quite a lot of what you were just saying. I definitely had heard about the postcode lottery system with treatment, but it's just so sad to know that where you live dictates like how much, you know, how many treatments you can get or how many times, and that's just a really incredibly sad thing to think about. In terms of Fertility Network. What can people do to show their support, whether that's, you know, people going through fertility struggles or just people that want to support the charity? What can they do to help?
Well, if you are going through fertility struggles, do reach out to us, whether that's joining one of our peer groups, whether that's we have webinars, any of our information sources, do reach out to us. We are here to help you. But to anybody who would like to support us, we have people who fundraise for us, whether you're running a marathon or in Scotland, they do the kilt walk. So if you'd like to fundraise for us, that would be absolutely fantastic. Donations, we rely on donations, we rely on fundraisers. We're a small charity with a massive amount of work to do. You can help us keep the support line open, help us continue to provide all the peer support groups. And also, if you want to volunteer for us, some of our groups are run by volunteers. I would say volunteers are the heart of our charity. So if you feel you have something to offer in terms of volunteering, whatever skills you have, do get in touch with us, because we want to hear from you. We're a small charity with a lot to do, and we really want to grow. And we can do that with your support, whether that's through donations or volunteering.
Thanks so much. That was a lot of good takeaways for kind of everyone there. But thank you for coming on the podcast. We really do appreciate it. And I'm sure that a lot of people like myself have learned a lot from today, you know, where to go for support, but just raising awareness for it in particular, and how employers and organisations can support those people going through fertility struggles. So thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me, Bronte.
You've been listening to the Thrive Content Cast. Visit www.thrivelearning.com for more information.